This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 7, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, magical practitioner and author Andrea Vitimus, as well as a second one-on-one dialogue with musical diviner and author Ezra Sanzer Bell. This episode looks to explore the question of, what is magic? I would argue that, in the same way science is a methodology for dialoguing with nature, so too is the practice of magic. The legitimacy of each is largely a matter of perspective. Symmetries between science and magic shouldn't surprise us all that much, considering the practice of modern science emerged out of Hermetic mystery schools. If we entertain the idea that consciousness is not merely an illusion generated by our own brain chemistry, and if we acknowledge that different levels of reality likely coexist side by side with our own, then the practice of magic, whether that be invocation, divination, the crafting of sigils, or whatever, suddenly doesn't seem so ridiculous. Thanks again to my guests, and thanks to you for listening. Joining me today on Pentimental is author Andrea Vitimus. Andrea wrote a really awesome book called Hands-on Chaos Magic. He has been a practicing magician for a number of years, I think over 15. But with that said, I'll let Andrea really introduce himself a bit more and let us know who he is and what he's about.
It's getting to be a long time that I've been practicing magic. Probably now it's probably going closer to 20. Because the book was, when I said 15, was written 5 years ago. So, but I've been initiated as a Hugon. I have a degree in psychology. I have one master's degree in computer science. I'm working towards a second. I have neurolinguistic and hypnosis training and Reiki attunements. Lots of different explorations of the spiritual to try to weed out the bad stuff and find the good stuff. So I have a lot of experience in various metaphysical circles from New Age to really hard occult. Try to keep a open mind about it and see what works and what doesn't. That's probably the best introduction I could do.
Why don't you explain a bit about your book, Hands-on Chaos Magic? So you're a practicing chaos magician, and this book is meant in ways to be an introductory text, perhaps, to that subject matter. So I guess what's the best way of introducing that, the subject generally, and maybe a bit about its history and where it comes from?
Well, to understand chaos magic, you have to almost come to this postmodern realization that has occurred in art, it's occurred in science, it's occurred in literature, and in some forms of avant-garde music, you know, that the observer dictates the meanings of the situations and pieces of art that they are seeing. Fundamentally, there is no system of magic that chaos magic is. It's not a system of magic. It's not a system, you do X, Y, and Z, and you get this. It's an idea about how magic works. But it's an idea about how the universe works. Essentially, one of the oaths that you take in the order that I was a part of, you know, for a long time, and that chaos magicians will generally agree with, is that there may be no ultimate truth. And for the people who follow truth, absolutely, this is a horrifying idea. But there's a real practical example of why, in the age of endless information, that it might be impossible to come to any other conclusion, but there may be no ultimate truth. And that's truth with a capital T. You might find some workable truths in your life that have a small t that aren't universal truths. But the reason is, let's say you start out in magic and you do runes for like 10 years. You become a rune master. You get magical results, observable, tangible results. And then one day you go to a Buddhist temple and you decide you're going to switch everything up and you become a Buddhist. You learn the different rituals and prayers and you get it really down. And those two worldviews, a runic Norse view versus a Buddhist view, are completely, mostly incompatible. Not completely, but you'd have to work to rectify those two things. But yet the techniques, when used with devotion and fervor, work in both cases to make synchronicities and magical operations and personal change occur. Fundamentally, there's people who have actually done this type of thing, and originally chaos magicians would do this all the time. They would really get down one or two paradigms and really see that, well, how can both of these things work if anything's absolutely true? Either we have to account for the fact that nothing is true and everything is permitted, or the fact that there is no truth to start with and we are empowering the beliefs. Now, there's a very mechanical view where you have to start looking at, well, what are my results if I can't rely on authority? Most magical systems and most magical ideas rest upon the notion of authority. This is the way we did it. This is the way we're always going to do it. But our understanding from a scientific worldview isn't necessarily bad. But anyone in our culture right now, in the post-information age culture where we can have access to everything that man has practically come up with on our cell phones, and we still choose to view cat videos, but that's okay. You know, we still have this in our pocket, anything. We could be out in the forest doing rituals. We need to get stuff in some occult manner. There's something on our cell phone we can reach out to, and there's very few secrets that the internet's not touching. In this kind of age, it makes sense that we have to look at it and say, well, what is truth? And if you throw out the idea of truth, which is quite liberating, you have to ask other questions. Like, do you believe that the other magicians practicing without authority are getting the results they claim? If they are getting the results that they are claiming, then that serves as a basis of a new sort of authority. The basis of what in science would be classically considered the scientific method. Is what you're doing changing your life? Is it getting stuff to go better? Are you getting synchronicities to fall in line? It's not quite so clear cut a yes or no answer, but it's a lot clearer cut than relying on authority. And so we see that one of the things about chaos magic that people don't really know is that chaos magic and Wicca are almost as old as each other. Chaos magic started out in the UK when the punk scene was like at its height. And that kind of punk ethic still permeates everything in chaos magic to really strike out against authority, especially authority that's not warranted. Now, if you use some techniques, you're working as a working Buddhist and you're getting really good results, that's great. That does lead credence to what you have to say. But by forcing the issue to go back to, is this really working? Am I really getting things to improve, of getting synchronicities, it puts a much harder metric on all the magic. And that idea that there might not be a truth and that the results of what you're doing dictate how useful a belief is one that we can carry across various different disciplines.
You have some background as a psychologist, and also you're well read in neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP. How do these factor into your views on magic, and does this kind of create a barrier between what is objective and subjective, or how do you delineate between those two things in these sorts of experiences or rituals or whatever?
Personally, I think there's a much finer line between the subjective and the objective than people think, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that, because our memories are inherently flawed. Any memory is already subjective. So we don't really, inside our heads, have an objective reality at all. In addition, even if the same person is viewing the same recorded piece of art or documentary or any combination, they will not have the same perspective on it. They'll interpret it different right from the start. So this idea that we really have as much objective reality is probably not so much one that I would agree with. We almost have subjective reality intersecting in our perspective at every single point of existence, from how you look at your day, even people who have jobs. I mean, you know, you can say the job sucks, right? And that's a perspective, and it could have elements you don't like, but ultimately that's your perspective on it. Just like we could have magical events that occur, and again, oftentimes it's going to be your perspective on it. And has that perspective shifted as a result of what you're doing? Have you shifted as a result of your doing? These notion of that either or kind of is why I think science, not all science, but the real hard materialists have such problems with religion, and why religious people have such problem with an idea like maybe it's both at the same time, because it doesn't lend itself to the kind of cultural, spiritual milieu that in the Western idea we've been raised on, which is this clear separation between mind and, you know, spirit. And that's maybe not what shamans used to believe or other indigenous cultures at all.
So I guess the question I have then is, where did you approach magic when you first started as far as viewing human consciousness? And then where have you come? Maybe, yeah, it's both at the same time, wave particle duality, that kind of thing. But how does that apply to consciousness for you?
Well, I had an interesting set of experiences when I first started out with magic. I didn't really want to be involved in magical stuff at all. Those people in my family were interested in it, but I kind of thought it was ridiculous. And the interesting thing is, I didn't really break that down. I actually got a psychology degree because I wanted to understand the inner universe and the subjective universes better. So I could, like most people, I think, that get psychology degrees, improve myself or at least understand myself better. It came out to be that events got really weird in my life, where people would physically see shadows around me move. They didn't tell me that until later. You know, it really broke my head open when other people are saying the shadows look like people, and when the shadows move like that, they scare me, so I've avoided you. So I had a real rough time when I first started with kind of this sort of magical path, because I wasn't sure what to believe. You know, I was coming from a hard, mostly materialist point of view, and had gotten thrown into a mostly hard spiritual point of view. And to be honest, I think there's real development if you can cross those two lines. And that's kind of where I'm working now. Where can the spiritual come into physical reality? Where is some aspects of science? Not that I could be an expert on quantum physics, but where is science starting to look at indeterminate effects or observer effects? You know, where is medicine starting to say, you know, that whole placebo effect works better than most of our drugs, which magicians and occultists have known that for thousands of years. Yeah, of course, the idea of the placebo and how it affects your mind dictating to your body what should happen has a better effect than many drugs. That makes sense to me. So there's all kinds of interesting areas where collectively we could probably get ahead as a society, as well, minus the issues we have now socially and things, but we could get ahead if we lose this idea of rational materialism and just have rational and ask different questions. It even comes down to the fact that the different questions that we could ask were being asked by all the founders of science. Most of the founders of science were alchemists, magicians, otherwise classified themselves as sorcerers. It isn't just superstition. You know, science has great and wonderful tools to tell us how to examine the world around us. What science doesn't tell us is any ethical qualms about how to use it. that's what all of the spiritual disciplines talk about.
And what's interesting for me is someone that's coming at the subject matter more from a scientific perspective. So I've read what there's to read on quantum physics. I've read what there's to read also on chaos theory, which actually has all kinds of interesting parallels with chaos magic itself. And I'm sure that's not just a historical fluke when, say, it erupted in the 80s or so, around the same time chaos theory was coming into fruition with the advent of computers and what have you. So there's a interesting intersection there. But yeah, I mean, you can see that there are physical correlations between what people have been calling superstition or magic for thousands of years and actually what science, quote unquote, is discovering through computers or other types of methodology that reveals something like the butterfly effect. Small things, fluctuations create large changes in far from equilibrium systems, they're called, if you want to get exotic about it. And magic, again, like something as simple as burning a sigil and throwing it into the wind, has this sort of same symbolic gesture as you're throwing out something small into the currents of a system and having it create change for you. So it's really an understanding actually of how the universe works, even if someone wants to say, oh, that they're just enacting something or it's a drama play, but it actually represents something very deep.
But the idea, that reducto argument of it's a drama play, I've heard that numerous times. And where do most things start as? Most things in our culture start as ideas. They start in the mind. So to reduce the power of ideas down to it's just a drama play, although I could get into the whole Dionysian mysteries and how much they impacted Western society, that's not the tone that's being used, right? It's just a drama play. Well, whether or not you think it's just a drama play, every single element of our society starts in the mind. In some case, we don't have a society that we're really concerned anymore about. Well, we are in some cases, but in general, we're not out in the elements. The ideas coming out now are all mind ideas. They start in the mind. Someone has an idea. They carry it through to fruition. You know, something like a sigil, if you want to really get it, materialist mindsets, you can acknowledge that they might be right. And it doesn't matter anyway. Because if the sigil makes changes to the subconscious mind, which impact the results, it's a moot point. And that's exactly one way you could describe it. That's not necessarily the way I think it works, but it's certainly still you've made changes to the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind acts as a butterfly in itself, and the changes ripple through your whole life. Boom. I mean, you could even argue that even by doing a sigil for something or doing creative visualization, you started to reframe what you focus on, and those changes come about because your subconscious mind, your conscious mind can't possibly pay attention to all the sensory input. So now it's just paying attention to sensory input and thoughts that are more aligned with a goal. Does that make it any less powerful? Absolutely not. This reduction to absurdity doesn't really make it any less powerful if you're really concerned about improving your life. Now, that said, I don't necessarily believe that it's all just in your head, but for the people who do understand, a lot of the magic that people do still would be quantifiably effective if you look at the results after the fact. Essentially, okay, so maybe we're wrong on the mechanisms, but it still works in their lives, in the tangible, if you tangibly look at people's lives who actually really seriously practice, and we can get into an argument about what that means or discussion about what that means, but the people who really take it seriously and really practice, guess what? Almost always it's reflected in their lives in a way that is verifiable, and it doesn't matter what the mechanism is at that point.
So you wrote a book on the basics of it. So what sort of is practice for you and your experience? And I know that's a rather expansive question, but I guess how do you go about being a magician? What do you do to manifest things in your life? Or what are some of the basics that people even need to grasp? Because I think people would be surprised how actually introspective most of the early stuff is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think if people listening to the show think that magic is the Hollywood version of magic. Hollywood makes it look so fun, doesn't it? I mean, Leviosa.
Right.
Right. I mean, any one of the Hollywood movies is so fun, but in actuality, most serious magical paths across, not all, some use different methods or come from societies that are much more spiritually oriented, so they don't have these elements. But most serious Western-related traditions involve at first just sitting still and learning how to listen to your thoughts and body control, learning to sit still, basically, which is fascinating because if you study our culture from a sociological point of view, you know, we are constantly in information overload land all the time. And what happens is if you are in information overload all the time, you can't think as clearly or as well. That's a scientific fact. And so what are most occult schools saying is the first thing to do is sit still in a quiet room and just focus on your breath. That's more Zen meditation. Or in my book, I talk about staring at a wall or basic, simple stuff where you're just learning to listen to your own thoughts and then realize how many of the thoughts are there and how quickly it rotates through different thoughts. And if you actually do this number of times, you realize during the day, we're very, very much not really even focused, not even focused on the task per se. Our mind drifts all the time. And so really what you're learning to do is just focus on one thing for a while. This is not a skill that the majority of the culture has. In fact, it is a skill that we could argue is pushed down in our society, that if people could do this, they would be able to focus on one thing for a while and not let the things bothering them tear them apart. And by not being able to focus on what they need to at that point, even that in itself, just breathing and focusing on one thing and understanding you have all these internal voices and not letting negative voices tear you apart, even that would make a tremendous change in people's lives. Unbelievable change in their effectiveness to deal with the modern world.
And I guess so often we're trained to constantly distract ourselves, that it's never a option to even sit still. And that if you see a kid sitting still and staring, there must be something wrong with them. Oh, they're autistic or whatever. If they can't sit still and they're like expressing themselves or whatever, obtaining trance states through running around like crazy people, which is, I think, basically what they're doing. Oh no, we have to put them on medication too, because that's, they can't express themselves the way they feel the need to. And so much of magic is tapping into that.
Well, right. But it's not just magic, right? You know, magic is a science and an art. When I'm putting together rituals and doing it, it's both science and art. But I think other artists have the same type of issue. They have to learn to kind of separate out the voices, to get in the flow, you know, and this is something that our society typically, as you just pointed out, says, don't do that. Now, there's a whole bunch of arguments that you can make of why that is. I don't know how much beefiness and hate mail we want to get in the show, but suffice to say, if somebody wants to sell you something, do you think they have your best interest at heart? And everything in our society is about selling you something. If you're able to focus on one thing, on a goal, if you're able to focus and let some of the negative voices go inside your mind that may not be from you, do you think most people would need to buy as much stuff? I don't think so. It's the same reason that certain psychoactive chemicals are banned, because they force reflection. They force reflection. They force self-transformation. We're not even getting into the synchronicities or magic yet, but even the act of deciding to listen to yourself and learning about yourself in this way using meditation and focus, well, it's not yet illegal, but certainly everything works against it, from people having to work 12 hours a day at their job or, you know, spending an hour to get to that job in addition to the 12 hours in traffic, or any number of things like how many Facebook likes do we have? They're all different means of distraction. So rightfully so, most spiritual development starts with focus.
In talking about synchronicity, then, I think maybe we can just jump into that real quick. Is synchronicity for you something that just happens that you then know how to move with, or it's actually a byproduct of the magical practice itself? It's something you help manifest or you're encouraged just by giving attention to it, or is it somewhere in between?
Yes, to all of those. I mean, right, if you're really good at magic, you can get physical effects that are really cool. You might even have physical manifestation of spirits. You have to get pretty good at that, at this to get that. But what's really important is when you start combining the focus that we talk about, the disciplined mind structure, and then you're starting to use stuff like sigil magic or servitors or various talking to spirits with a real plan. Okay. I mean, I'm not talking about you just do the magic and walk away. I mean, like you've sat down and did a real plan. Now, if you don't know how to do the planning, that's why you talk to like a life coach like me or someone else to get that plan down. But what happens is you have a real plan. And as people know, if you have a real plan, there's setbacks, but some things go your way because once you set your mind to it, it starts to happen after you get through the phase where you're like being tested. Now, once you start doing enchantments, you can make things start going your way even more at the right times. It's still not going to always go your way, even with the enchantments, but it's at a higher rate. Now, if you think about it, even if your enchantments give you internal fortitude and strength to keep going, that's very powerful. Most people don't ever even go that far. So you have to think that in all the cases, the kind of synchronicity is flowing your way to get the luck you need, and the magic are happening at the same time. And oftentimes, the magic will speed up the process. If you have a well-formed plan, you're doing the things you need to in life, you're addressing the negative, internal negative constructs or voices or energies, whatever you want to call them, to kind of get some sort of clarity, and that takes a lot of effort, and you really put your passion behind it, you'll see that doing magic for things you need on that road really, really speeds up the process of getting down that road. That's what we all want, right? It's not just getting ahead, but we want to be the best we can, as it were.
And when we're talking about magic, really, we're talking about probabilities, right? There's, I think, an obsession with certainty and control that is actually contradictory to what the actual magical practice or path, whatever, entails, which is really just you're skewing probabilities in your favor. Like, I come from a poker background, and it's all about just how do you read the percentages and then skew the probabilities in your favor.
It is. It is much more about probabilities than it is probability manipulation. That said, you can do some what I would consider, I don't want to say gross, but I don't mean gross as in icky. I just mean there's some pretty flagrant magic that you can do once you get better at it. But that takes time and practice. That's kind of on the level of stuff where you're trying to demonstrate that magic is real. So you can have spiritual contacts that violate that. But even then, the way spirits trade, you're still in a system. We're still in a system. There's opposing forces, even if a spirit physically manifests, there's opposing forces in the system that may not allow for what you're trying to do. You might have to work harder than you thought. It depends on where you're at, where you're trying to go, how aligned you are with what you actually kind of want, not just what society tells you you want. And that's key, because you're not going to have a lot of passion behind the work 80 hours a week and pass out when you go home and never see your family. That most people, they cannot get behind that. And rightfully so, they shouldn't. So some of this is actually a combination of knowing you're trying to figure out what actually makes yourself tick and skewing the probabilities. And sometimes you get real weird shit happening and it's cool. But in general, you're absolutely right. It's much more of stacking the deck in your favor. Because oftentimes, if you really study the probabilities of things and study the odds with people, the odds aren't in people's favor. And magic is a way to kind of, in some cases, equalize those odds. At least give you the internal fortitude to ignore the odds.
So where do you stand on spirits? Are these always archetypal internal structures that we build out of thin air and then project into the new sphere that other people can draw on? Or is it this other layer of external entities that are good and bad or angelic and demonic? Are these all just labels? Again, is it just wave particle where it's both at the same time?
I think the wave particle, there's probably third options too, but the wave particle is exactly right. Like how you approach the spiritual world is often how it will respond. Now you can do experiments that test there is a spiritual world, but in all practice, they cannot possibly exist in the same time space coordinates that we do, right? They don't have an existence of time in the same exact way we do, or space, one of the two, right? Because if they did, there would probably be a physical entity, at which point they would have the same constraints that we have. So even if they exist, they don't exist in the same state that we do. And the way that you generally approach them is through resonance of mind. So to say that they're just archetypal forces, I don't want to go there because in my life, I haven't just seen them be archetypal forces. Weird stuff has happened to me, and weird stuff has happened to a lot of people I know. You know, especially if you hang out with paranormal investigators, something's going on. It doesn't seem like it's just in your head. And if you treat them more personally than just an archetype with respect, it seems like you get better results. However, that said, no mind, no spiritual contact. Essentially, like, if the mind's not in the right place, it doesn't matter, usually, with some notable exceptions, but they're vastly the minority. So it's yes, it's that wave and particle thing. And this is actually a real problem with modern occultism, right? To argue both points, it seems like chaos magic was one of the first to say, who gives a crap, right? It's probably both. And it doesn't matter if we endlessly talk about it. But the general occult culture gets obsessed by talking about that very, those dichotomies, which are probably best left to be answered in a yes manner or a all of the above. People get really hung up on that, especially when you read lots of occult books, and they'll argue this point back and forth about which way is it. And the fact is that it's counterproductive usually to what generally people want to get out of spirituality and magic.
Well, and you're dealing with these sorts of realities, however you want to define that. How do you draw the line between when you experience something as good or angelic or evil or bad or demonic? And is there good and evil, or are these on a spectrum, or what's going on?
Let's deconstruct that too. What is good and evil? Well, the first answer is if we're Nietzsche, you know, we're beyond good and evil and, you know, the Übermensch and all that kind of stuff. But there's something to that idea of who determines what is good or evil. You know, demons are a great example of what is good or evil. Most people don't realize that our modern classical demons in the Western tradition originally were Canaanite gods before the Jews were in that area. They were the gods of the people of those areas, the nature spirits, the things that kept the cities running. Now, if you're from a purely Christian point of view, you absolutely think those are demons, for lots of reasons. But from a historical point of view, it isn't at all clear that those are just demons. So who gets to decide what's good and evil is a very political idea. It is also one that dictates how a society runs and other things. So all of these political aspirations are pushing themselves down upon our spiritual beliefs. This is another reason I think chaos magic is so liberating, because you could just say, well, I don't believe any of that, because how do we know what's historically valid and what's a propaganda from one sect versus another? We often don't. And so it comes back to getting the results thing. So what's good and evil depends on where you're at in your perspective. Now, there's things that I would consider closer to evil, and there's things I would consider closer to good, but they probably will be different for each person. And what we cannot ignore is how much of an impact on what good and evil means derived from the culture that we live in that's primarily Christian. For instance, I can guarantee you if we were raised as Norse Vikings, we would have a different view of good and evil than our culture does right now. I can guarantee if I went over to, not to get super political about things, but if I went over to, you know, some Tea Party factions and heard what they thought was good and evil, it'd be radically different than other Christians I know. So we can't get away from this politicization of what is good and evil. But we can ask questions that look more like, is this helpful or not in my life? And that seems to be much more valuable to ask.
So in certain haunting scenarios or something like that, which I don't know if you've been pulled in to assist with certain situations like that or not, but people will be quote unquote oppressed, or they're getting scratches, or what's going on with situations like that, if you have a perspective on it at all.
It depends on the situation in a lot of cases. It depends on what's going on in the situation, right? Because sometimes like, when you're dealing with stuff like that, the dead don't know that they're actually dead. Sometimes it's, they're not clear what it's doing. And sometimes it's just a malevolent entity that is more atavistic and primal. It doesn't understand or care what it's doing. And you just got to get rid of it. But keep in mind, you're dealing with an intelligence at that point that's probably similar to an animal. And it could feel trapped. Is that evil? Or does it feel trapped? Does it feel like you're in its territory? And what are you doing in its territory? Right. We trade houses all the time. Sometimes spirits are there longer than the people. So is that evil, or does it just feel trapped and you imposing our views on its, what it considers its home? So this notion, again, if someone came into my home and was squatting and I thought it was my home, I might defend myself. And you kind of get into these kind of questions if you really understand that is the case a lot of the time. And there, a perspective of spirit isn't necessarily going to be the perspective that we have. So, you know, in some of those cases, sure. It's not helpful to the people who are there. It's certainly acting aggressive. You know, is it carte blanche evil? Now, if you bring in a Christian exorcist, a Catholic church exorcist, they're going to say, that's a demon, it's evil. You know, a shaman or someone who's closer to shamanic views like me might say, well, it's just not helpful. And maybe we can put it somewhere else because it's here and it's just not helpful in this situation. Maybe if we give the spirit healing, it would be helpful in a different situation.
So yeah, you bring up shamanism there. How do you see your tradition tied to, say, indigenous shamanism, or is there a direct line, or is there some kind of quantum leap from there to here?
Well, I mean, there's no way that we could say that chaos magic is tied to indigenous forms of shamanism. That would just be rude. But we can say that because chaos magic is there's not really a thing of chaos magic. Certainly many of us have studied indigenous forms of shamanism to understand what are they getting at. And so we can kind of make comments about the effectiveness of their rituals and the effectiveness of their understanding of how they would interact with the world for better or worse. So we can't really say, yes, we are the modern. I mean, first, I wouldn't say, you know, because chaos magic's the only idea, I would probably refer to myself as more shamanic, but other chaos magicians be vastly different because no one can agree on anything because, you know, there's an idea, anyone can do anything. But that said, we can look at what indigenous shamans were doing with respect and understand there's a lot of validity to their methods.
Now, I've heard you bring up in other conversations this idea of the aggregor, which I find just interesting. And like you said, you could probably talk for an entire episode about it, but maybe you could just summarize what it is and why you see it's relevant in society, if at all.
Well, if you have a purely materialist view, it's not relevant, right?
No, it's not. But I don't think we're talking to too many of those, so it's all good.
Except for the fact that you can use an egregore different ways and even the word in different ways. But we'll give an example of a corporate example. Do you notice that corporations have symbols which represent them? They seem to have an intelligence and a culture that when you join a corporation or work for a corporation, you are expected to acclimate to the culture. This is an overriding, pervasive thing. In fact, most corporations seem to have a personality. Not a human personality, obviously. And that, in sense, is pretty much egregore encompasses that. It is a essence of a what would be much more like a modern god form. And in corporations really work, except they're perhaps not as personifiable as the old god forms of old. They still act in an egregoric manner, consistent with their own personality, and have an impact on the people who are part of the corporation, down to a level of changing their personality in radical ways. This is not unlike quite possibly what would happen with god forms in city-states in our history. It's not to say that the gods of old were egregores, but it does say in the modern world that some of these corporations seem to be acting that way. And if we understand that from a spiritual point of view, what does that mean? It means that these corporations, which are capable of, seemingly capable of having a personality, acting in a willful manner to direct themselves through all of their workers and creating massive changes to the reality we live in, if we take those as a spiritual entity that is acting on our physical plane, they're immensely powerful right now. Now, for the people listening who are skeptical and saying, well, a corporation couldn't possibly be a spiritual entity, I would just say, try summoning one once, and I bet something will show up, and it'll scare the crap out of you. Because if everyone is part of this collective, it is going to form a spiritual construct around it just by the virtue of the fact that all these people are feeding into the same culture and personality structure. And that's probably the clearest way I can talk about egregore in that way. So now that means that things like the Catholic Church has an egregore. Things like magical orders, they have egregores. You know, things like a brand personality like Andrea Vitamus has an egregore, for better or worse, that is not fully in control of the people who directly touch it.
This reminds me a bit. You mentioned that, again, this would have no application or no relevance to materialists, but the truth is that there are ideas in materialist science that support the concept of whatever, a holographic universe, a information storing vacuum, a conditionable space-time. You can manufacture or prime the field or do these things. You can manipulate space itself in these ways we don't fully yet understand. And you go to, say, David Bohm's interpretation of quantum physics, and he has this way deep down, this thing called the quantum potential or an information potential, and it's embedded with quote-unquote information. And the truth is, like, we're just connected to this at a deep microphysics level that we can't escape it. We're braided through with fucking space-time itself. So the thought that there could be no interaction whatsoever or there can be no actual physical connection, even though it's well below our level of awareness, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So again, like, we just don't have the instruments to detect it. Does that mean it doesn't exist? We didn't think the atom existed for 2,000 years. Democritus was called an idiot. And it was all random speculation until, you know, Rutherford came around and figured out how to detect it. That took a long fucking time. So people can kind of get these things well before they're, whatever, proven in the materialist vein, if that makes sense.
And the truth is, we don't need to prove it in a materialist vein, because if the model I'm suggesting works, if you're purely being an open scientist, and I can guarantee what I'm talking about, if you treat a corporation as an aggregator, you'd be surprised at your ability to predict what it'll do. At that point, you can even say it's just the model, but still, just even as a model, it really does kind of predict how many of these groups interact. The myth is that corporations act in a logical way. They don't. They act like cumbersome god forms that claw their way across things. They don't even always act in the best interest of their own financial gain. So it's amazing when you actually sit down from a business standpoint and analyze what decisions are made and how not about money some decisions are.
Taking this back to the beginning a little bit, can you maybe give some introductory, just small practices people could do to get acquainted with whatever, however you can start conditioning yourself or just getting in a state of mind where magic might manifest, because you speak so much of it, be getting into trance or an altered state to be open to the experience to begin with, right?
Yeah, I mean, first, cut off your TV watching for a week. And then stare at a wall for as long as you can every day. You know, just start out trying 5-10 minutes and just breathe as deeply as you can. That's enough. And just pay attention to your thoughts. And that sounds so ridiculously simple, but trust me, even getting away from the television for a week and consciously changing your patterns there is really hard. Much credit to anyone who does it. And then, like I said, the second week, just stare at a point on the wall, breathe as deeply as you can, try to go from 5 minutes to 10 in the first week and see if you can do it without getting fidgety in your chair, and see how long you can go increasing your breathing and staying sitting still in the chair and focusing on the wall without excessive breath, and just write down how long you get to each time. So you need to stop watch for that. And I guarantee if someone did those two things, after 2 weeks, they might have a little aha moment, maybe not a life-changing aha moment. They might just have a certain clarity, and that certain clarity will make other questions come into focus. And that's really, that simple thing can change that much.
Well, at its heart, magic really is about changing habits, right? To a point where it's guided towards a more productive purpose. So, well, not completely. Okay, I'm just simplifying.
At the first stages, it's a good way to think of it. Later, that's probably not what it is. But in the beginning stages, all those self-help books are really helpful. Later on, maybe it changes to something else. And that something else, and synchronicity management and playing with the universe, are different goals. But when you're first starting out, even just becoming aware of your own habits is a powerful tool.
Where do you come down on astral projection and OBE, and what is the use of that? If you do it, what use are you making out of it? And yeah, how do you spend your time, I guess, in that practice?
Well, the thing about out-of-body and astral projection is that it's difficult at first. And it's difficult not in the ways people think. You know, everyone thinks, oh, I'm saying, oh, it's difficult. What the hell does that mean? By difficult, I mean it lends itself to fantasy, to obsession. Before you're doing out-of-body experiences and astral work, you really need to have all these fundamentals of focus, mental discipline, emotional control all down. Now, that said, I have personally done various experiments with astral and out-of-body experience that were quite awesome, including one time where I was working with another magician and I was able to cause a bruise from the astral plane. There's verifiable results. Also, you know, you can do lots of really solid magic from the astral plane to influence our reality. So it's not just that it's, you're not doing anything. It's just that initially when people do this stuff, there's just too many areas where until you get the mental discipline, it goes into just flights of fancy, flights of daydreaming, but you have to be a lot deeper than a daydream. So it can be quite effective magic, quite powerful, and you can get quite awesome. And I mean that in the clearest sense of the word, awesome insights and awesome results, but it takes a lot of discipline to get there. And that's unfortunate because it's one of the big things of the kind of new age community is out of body and astral travel. But often my guideline for a successful astral thing is first, your body will feel quite different when you come back. And there'll be probably changes that other people notice. They might not know what occurred, but they might say, are you wearing your hair different? That's more of a sign that something occurred. Those little note, people don't know what they're seeing in you, only that something's changed. They'll make comments about it. Those kind of comments are feedback to you. They're noticing something is different. So that said, a lot of what I do is astral and out of body work. It's hard to get it right when you're first starting out in magic.
Yeah, Andrea, so perhaps in getting close to wrapping up here, maybe you can tell us about where your focus is right now, what you're working on. Is any other new book coming out? Are you doing any workshops, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I have a couple things going on. I'm always working on new books. Problem is I'm not finishing them too quickly. In August, I will be running a shapeshifting, an etheric, mental, and a little bit of physical shapeshifting year course. That's on my website. We did this course over the month version of this course over December and November, and people, it was phenomenal. People had tremendous transformations in their life, and I expect the year course to have similar effect. People have tremendous changes in their life for the better. So that'll start at the middle of August. I am working on a book on fire magic and a book on not classical, but various forms of fairy magic from a not necessarily completely Victorian, nice fairy type magic. So I am going in a much more shamanic route. And I, of course, do life coaching on a regular basis. That's heavily weighted towards spiritual life coaching, but my view of spirit and life is that they're integrated. So what I try to do is make sure that the people's lives get improved as they tend to their inner garden as well as the outer garden.
All right. So Andrea, thank you again for being with me today on the show. It's been a really informative talk. Thank you again for your time and your expertise today.
Thank you for having me.